Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 9th of April 2017. My name's TLP Watson and this week I'm joined by Gareth James. We're now going to talk about consent at the National Theatre, in the Dorfman Theatre. This is a new play by Nina Rain. And it's directed here by Roger Michel with a set design by Hildegard Bechtler. Actually, the set design is a large platform where things come up and down through trapdoors. And other than the furniture, the only thing that really depicts what is going on are lights that drop down from above to show you whose flat it is. This production stars Priyanka Burford, Pip Carter, Ben Chaplin, Heather Craney, Daisy Haggard, Adam James, and Anna Maxwell Martin. It concerns a group of, well, barristers and various partners, and also begins with two of these barristers facing off against each other in a rape case. Gareth, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
Well, the play juxtaposes issues about our legal system, particularly in rape cases, with what's happening in the lives of these people who are mostly involved in the legal profession. And I thought it worked remarkably well because it uncovers three things about our legal system, two of which I kind of knew and one I didn't know or hadn't thought of, really. And one is about the fact that an adversarial system that we have actually encourages a great deal of competition between the actual barristers, the actual players in the game. And sometimes that competition is at the expense of justice or fairness, because the need to win can sometimes override the truth, the justice, and the facts. The second thing it uncovers, which I also had already had a view about, is the fact that it's possible or indeed common for people who are outside the court, friends or colleagues, to go against each other, to advocate against each other in the legal system. And I can't think of another aspect of society where that would frankly be allowed. In business, which is the world I know, that would be considered a conflict of interest. It would be considered a great risk of collusion. And I think it's extraordinary that it's allowed in the legal system here. And the third, which I hadn't really thought about, which I think is really quite important, is that in criminal law, there is no representation for the victim. The defense has a representative and the Crown has the prosecution, but the prosecution is not representing the victim. So in fact, the victim is alone. The victim has no advocate, has no representation. And that sort of struck me as really rather unfair, particularly in the case of things like rape cases where the victim is very vulnerable. And I think all of these things lead to an unacceptable situation in something like a rape case, because it means that the barristers behave in a way that is completely unacceptable, by bullying and by questioning inappropriately the victim because they want to win. And I don't think it's about truth and justice. I think it's a flawed legal system. And that, for me, at the sort of issues level, that's what this play lays out for us and does so very well, in my opinion. And it does it through the lives of these two couples. And we have one couple, which is Ed and Kitty, and Ed is a barrister, and he's the barrister who's up against Tim in this case that's weaved into it. And he's married to Kitty, who isn't a barrister. They've just had their first child. And the other couple, well, they're both barristers, Rachel and Jake, but neither of them are involved in this particular case that we see. And then Tim, who is the barrister who's up against Ed, is a friend stroke colleague. And then the final main character is Kitty's best friend, who's actually an actress, who's frankly the only sympathetic character apart from the victim, the only sympathetic character in the piece. And the way it explores these issues is through the infidelities happening in their lives, really, because initially there are issues between Rachel and Jake, which Ed and Kitty get involved in as friends. And then later there are issues between Ed and Kitty, which Rachel and Jake get involved with as friends. And Kitty's best friend gets involved with Tim. So that's a sort of extra sort of dimension. So it's showing through the kind of connection of these relationships, at the same time exploring these issues with the legal system, particularly as far as rape is concerned. I thought it was a very, very well-written play. I thought it was very well-structured, very simply staged, just on this platform with the audience effectively on four sides, two sides in the stalls, but two opposite sides in the tiers as well. But I thought that gave it a kind of goldfish bowl kind of feel to it, which seemed very appropriate for the material. And I thought the director had got just great performances out of a cast of, well, out of a good cast who gave great performances. And I really liked all of them. And Heather Craney, who has a relatively small role as the victim, is very, very important because she plays this with great passion. And she really kind of shakes us and wakes us up to, you know, this is real issues. There are real people being affected by all of this. So I found the play captivating. It just held me throughout. I thought it was, you know, simply but very well staged, beautifully acted, very well written. And I couldn't recommend it enough. And I've already, since I've seen it, been recommending it to quite a few friends to go and see it. It'll be a candidate, I suspect, for best play, certainly in my list, best play of 2017.
I was very impressed by this. I have to say, you've got a very good cast here. I mean, people like Anna James and Anna Maxwell Martin, you always expect good performances from them, and you certainly got them here. The person who impressed me, I think, the most was Ben Chaplin. I've seen him in a few things, and he's always been okay and good. You know, he's not a, I've never found him a particularly bad actor. But in this, he really, really impressed me. Something you were saying, yeah, actually this guy has gone from just being an actor who I know and is a fairly well-known actor, and, you know, I expect good performances from him, to being somebody who I will expect much better performances and really very interesting performances from him from now on. So that's a very impressive thing. It does deal with this subject of rape, the play treats with it. And the idea, as you say, that this confrontational thing, which doesn't really work in rape cases, and largely it's because, I think, I mean, it is this adversarial thing, but it is also this idea that in the case of acquaintance rape, which is what this is, there are always two things to be determined in a crime. Did the crime happen? And is the person in the dock guilty? Now, in an acquaintance rape, if the crime happened, the person in the dock is automatically guilty. It's a slightly different question. You're questioning not, is the person in the dock the guilty party? You're questioning, did the crime take place? But we are still treating it as if the person is innocent. The alleged rapist is automatically guilty if the crime took place. And as you say, nobody represents the victim or the alleged victim, if you're going to be proper about it. Nobody represents them. And also, in our adversarial system, we have the idea that the defendant is innocent until proven guilty, which by transference would mean that the victim or alleged victim is a lying whore until she is proven to be the victim, which I personally think is a very bad way of doing things. And actually, they should be spending a lot more time on working out whether or not the crime took place and getting into the truth of the incident rather than trying to trick somebody. It is a great fault, not just in our legal system. I think all people dealing with rape, it's very difficult, especially when you're talking about acquaintance rape. It's a very difficult system that I don't think any legal system has really got the answer to it, or at least I've not heard of any sort of great innovations where they come to the right conclusion. And of course, it's going to happen like this, and it is one of the ways that rape is badly handled in this country, and it puts people off not just prosecuting, but people complaining about rape and reporting rape. And I think it's a big problem. And, you know, I think this play illustrates it. I mean, obviously, I'm probably overthinking it with this play, but I think this play does effectively illustrate some of the problems behind the whole question, you know, the whole question of consent, as the play is titled. But it is, as you said, a very impressive play and some very impressive playing in it.
And indeed, the point you raise, I mean, that's why the play is called Consent, because we are dealing with issues of consent here. And as you say, the number of rape cases that come to court is much smaller because of the system. People are deterred from actually bringing these cases. So what we're doing is we're letting rapists off. The system is allowing rapists to go free.
We're now going to talk about Incident at Vichy, which is on at the Finborough Theatre. This is Arthur Miller's 1964 play, directed here by Phil Wilmot, with a design by Georgia de Grey. This play was originally done in 1964 and was put on in New York, and was put on in London in 1966. And I think this is pretty much the first major production they've had for, I think it's about 50 years, first professional production. What Phil Wilmot has done here is he's gone against some of Arthur Miller's rather exacting stage setup by making it a non-naturalistic setting. We are looking into essentially a white box where a group of 10 men are assembled. Actually, initially, I think it is only 7 men, and then the 3 come in a little bit later. But they are all assembled. It is supposed to be a police station in 1942 Vichy, and they have been picked up off the street to be examined. And this is about the time, I can't remember the exact things with Vichy, but basically Germany allowed the Vichy regime to be okay for the first couple of years after the fall of France. So in 1940, France collapses, they set up the Vichy regime. The Vichy regime is always a bit close to the Germans, but was nominally independent. But gradually that independence starts to get chipped away, especially when the Germans are, you know, fighting out back against things like the resistance, and also driving forward with their final solution of the Jewish problem, well, their extermination of the Jews. Let's not beat around the bush. So what we've got here is this group of people, some of whom might be Jews, some of them, a couple of them, or at least one of them might be a gypsy. They all are trying to keep themselves together, keep their thoughts to themselves, but they keep being annoyed by a man called Le Beau, who is a painter and a bit of a mummy's boy. He sounds a bit like that, always talking about his mother. He's played by Lawrence Bruffman and is probably one of the most noticeable characters. He picks on first on a man called Bayard, who's the only person who really responds to him. It's a man called Bayard, who is played by Brendan O'Rourke. He is an electrician who works at a big railway depot, and he begins to tell them fragments about people being put into cattle cars, and that he's encountered the Polish train drivers who tell him really nasty stories about what happens once you're in the cattle car and where you're taken to. But they're still, they don't know exactly what happens. They know people are taken off to camps, but they don't know what the camps are. They know that the camps are probably not going to be particularly nice. And the thing is that we gradually begin to see that one or two of these people, perhaps more of these people, might be Jewish and might become victims and be put into these cattle trucks and shipped off to Poland. Another major character who comes in slightly later is Le Duc, who is a doctor. He's a psychologist who trained in Vienna. He also is an ex-soldier who fought in the same battle as a German officer who is there. He's a member of the Wehrmacht. He is there unwillingly. He really wants this to be done by the SS or the Gestapo, what they're doing. But he is the German liaison officer. Among the other authority figures, we have a doctor who is doing the scientific measurement to find out if people are Jewish, and a police captain who is basically a Vichy collaborator. Among other people of the cast, we have P.K. Taylor playing Monceau, who is an actor. He is a man who has always denied his Jewishness, but stuck around in Paris after the invasion, after Paris was taken over in 1940, because he was playing Cyrano and wanted to continue playing Cyrano. And, you know, he's somebody who put his career in front of any worries that he might be Jewish. We also have Edward Killingback playing an Austrian aristocrat who has run away from Austria to settle here. It says Vichy, but we're not absolutely certain what this place is. You know, possibly not the town of Vichy or the city of Vichy. It might be another part of it. The Austrian aristocrat, it's possible, there's certain hints that he might be homosexual. He certainly has a great love of music, and one of his motivations for running away and also sympathising with the problems that the Jews had, was that he ran a little orchestra, like an 18th century princeling. He had his own personal orchestra, and some of the members of that orchestra were Jewish, and he wanted to protect those people, but was unable to in the end, and has therefore run away from all his Nazi friends in Austria, and basically settled himself in this town in Vichy, where these people have been rounded up, and he's been one of the number rounded up. The unworthy thoughts I had when I was watching this were that it's kind of like The Usual Suspects, in the way that we've got this very clean set. I mean, it really is just a white walls and a bench which is built into the set. It's very, very simple. And that did feel a little bit like the initial scene of The Usual Suspects, if you know that film. Another one, of course, is And Then There Were None, which has been the Agatha Christie story, which has had other names throughout its history. But it takes 10 people who one at a time disappear from the stage, and we get this idea of this number of people reducing in number each time, and as they are called in, and I think one person is given exit papers early on, but all the rest are simply never seen again, and you do kind of wonder what has happened to them. And one of the things that you get here is, because they do want to make the character of Le Beau this really aggravating and annoying painter who just wants to say something and just wants to keep questioning people. He probably don't know the answers, but he just he's trying to make conversation to make himself braver. He is an almost constant throughout, until right at the end of the play, but he needs sort of sparring partners with the others, and his early sparring partner is this Bayard the electrician, and then later it is Leduc the doctor, who becomes much more important, as does the Austrian aristocrat. And those three people make up the major part of all these prisoners who are being checked. It is a fascinating play. It is almost a mystery about why this play hasn't been seen before. It doesn't feel particularly Arthur Miller. This play was written between and something like After the Fall and The Price. It's after sort of the really great plays, but certainly After the Fall is a fascinating play and a very strange imaginative memory play. And The Price is, again, a very different play, but very set in the more familiar milieu of Arthur Miller, sort of a rundown Jewish place in New York, or in the New York area, sort of that kind of family relationship they have within The Price of the Place. So this is slightly out of the ordinary for Arthur Miller, but it does work extremely well. I think works extremely well in this production. Gareth, what did you think of this?
Well, I've waited a long time to see a professional production of this play. I saw an amateur production in a kind of dungeon in the Edinburgh Fringe many moons ago, which wasn't particularly good. And I'm also puzzled as to why we haven't seen it. You know, we're used to seeing rare productions of early and late plays by Miller, but actually in the middle part of his career, we see them more often. Although in fairness, both After the Fall and The Price, the ones that this is sandwiched between, we don't see as often as we see the big ones, like Crucible and All My Sons and Death of a Salesman and A View from a Bridge. So maybe it's because we do focus on the big plays, maybe too much, that it's therefore been neglected. There is a suggestion, I think, in the programme note that the fact it's 13 actors, all men, 90 minutes, may sort of deter production, perhaps. I don't know how true that is. But anyway, I've waited a long time, so I was, the minute I found out this was coming on, I pounced, which you often have to do at the Finborough Theatre, because they do sell out very quickly. And the great news for me is they really done it justice, I think. You're right in saying that they, like Ivo van Hove's A View from a Bridge at the Young Vic, they varied from the stage directions that Arthur Miller has given. And again, I think it benefits from that, because I think a less naturalistic setting does actually work better for a play like this. And I thought The White Box increased the intensity of the piece, and I found it very tense and very gripping. And I thought The White Box, because it was a claustrophobic space, actually did add something to that. I thought the characterizations were very finely detailed, and I thought the acting was all outstanding. I mean, there's some great performances here. I think what's interesting about the debate that's going on between them, because, they're sort of, first of all, they're talking about what's going to happen to them. So you've got the sort of the optimists, if you like, who say, well, it's just a document check. And then you've got others who are talking about theories of, you know, being taken away in trains and burned, which, of course, is the truth, ultimately. But they don't, for the first part of the play, they don't know what their fate is. But about halfway through the play, there's a conversation between the German officer and the professor, this kind of racial profiler of the day, as it were, where it's obvious that that is what's going to happen. So it becomes clearer to them before they're even hauled in. And the different reactions, obviously, some people are, you know, are kind of, lots of them are scared. Some of them are just in disbelief. You know, there are people there saying, well, how, you know, that they couldn't possibly do this. So you get a debate about the morality, I guess, of it all. But you also get different takes on what people will do to avoid it, you know, what people will do. And that kind of opens up the discussion about the motivation for collaboration in a way, in both a small scale and a big scale. So I thought the production worked very, very well indeed. I think it's actually a much better play than I think people say it is, based on, you know, what you hear about it before you see it, as it were. And I think that, well done again to the Finborough for sort of, you know, finding something neglected that some of us are desperate to see and giving it such a great production. It's the sort of play that would be nice to see transferring. And I'm thinking Trafalgar Studios 2 again as a sort of obvious space where they could have the same kind of intensity and the same kind of claustrophobia. So it would be nice to see a transfer. But anyway, from my personal selfish point of view, I have seen it. I'm delighted I've seen it, and I warmly, warmly recommend it.
I'm now going to talk about The Lottery of Love at the Orange Tree Theatre. This is John Foles' adaptation of Pierre Marivaux's 1730 play Le Jeu de l'amour et du hasard, directed here by the Orange Tree's artistic director Paul Miller. The cast includes Dorothea Meyer Bennett as Sylvia, the daughter of the house, Claire Lambs as Louisa, Sylvia's maid, Ashley Zangaza as Richard, Sylvia's potential suitor, Keir Charles as John Brass, Richard's manservant, with Pip Donaghy as Morgan, Sylvia's father, and Tam Williams as Martin, Sylvia's brother. John Fowles' version moves the action of the play from the 1730s to the Regency, slightly less 100 years later. This setting has been taken as permission by most reviewers to mention Jane Austen, although not all of them investigate any similarities between Jane Austen beyond her name. For me, this is still the Marivaux of the plays that I saw of his in the late 1990s and early 2000s. Plays like The Dispute, The Island of Slaves, and The False Servant. These are plays with a lot of debates about the nature of love and society and indeed human nature. But unlike those plays, the debates in this particular version are somewhat gentler, somewhat lighter, and they are part of the plot, but the plot doesn't stop in order for them to happen. This is a light 90-minute piece with a simple setup. Sylvia's father is keen for Sylvia to marry Richard, the son of an old friend. He is not prepared to force her, but is confident that they'll be happy. Sylvia decides to dress as her maid Louisa, so she can observe her future husband from a distance. While she is off exchanging clothes with her maid, her father receives a letter from his old friend warning him that Richard has decided to dress as his own servant, John Brass, and John Brass will pretend to be Sylvia's suitor. So, master and mistress pretend to be the servants, and vice versa. As you might expect, love blossoms, but strictly according to class. So, servants dressed as masters fall in love with each other, and masters and mistresses dressed as servants fall in love with each other. And, of course, the real conflict, therefore, becomes that each one thinking that they are falling in love with a servant or falling in love with a master, they find the conflicted passions there. But it all sort of kind of falls apart in the end, and everybody finds out who the other person is, and it all ends happily. It's a nice light piece, as I said, and a lot of fun. Dorothea Meyer Bennett and Ashley Zangaza are wonderfully worried as the master and the mistress, thinking that they have fallen in love with a well-spoken servant while having deep disdain for the rather vulgar masters and mistresses. Although it has to be said, Keir Charles is a little bit too brash and a little bit over the top for this play, perhaps. His performance is great fun, and he is too obviously wrong to be a posh person. Claire Lambs as Louisa is much more convincing as the mistress of the house, but she is still sort of rejected by Ashley Sangars as Richard, and he only has eyes almost from the start for this young maid who he will eventually marry, of course. It should be noted that Claire Lambs is about to perform in Richard Bean's play Kiss Me, which was downstairs at Hampstead and is now going into Trafalgar Studios 2 for a while. And she was very good in that. And indeed, she is very good in this. But I think she is given a little bit short shrift because, yeah, she's a very nice person. And I always find the cheeky maids the most interesting characters in French comedies anyway. So it's rather a pity that the master, the real master, doesn't have eyes for her and she has to put up with John Brass, who is a bit of an oaf, really. And you don't quite see the attraction with him in the same way that you see between Richard and Sylvia. That is very strong and very poignant at times. But it's great fun, and I would recommend it highly.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azetta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.